Hi, and thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines. This show is a weekly roundup of news featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. And today on the program, Ukrainian Latter-day Saints share stories of resilience in the face of a Russian invasion. Senator Mitt Romney calls Vladimir Putin a megalomaniac dictator. The state legislative session enters a frantic pace in its final days. And Salt Lake County's health director says some residents should still mask up even as COVID cases decline. And joining me for this conversation on the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty. And thanks for joining, Aaron. Glad you're here.
Thanks so much.
Of course. And then here in studio, two guests, which we haven't done for quite some time. Tribune Statewatch editor and reporter Jeff Parrott. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Great to be here.
Say that again. I didn't have your microphone on.
Great to be here.
glad you're with us. And Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We are going to begin today with an audio postcard. This is a compilation of some Ukrainian members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who the Tribune's Tamara Kemsley and Chris Samuels reached this week, who responded to questions about the invasion of their country by Russia. These interviews aired as part of the Tribune podcast called Mormonland. Take a listen, and then we'll come back.
I just want to thank people in Utah and actually all over the world, the returned missionaries and friends, and just good people everywhere in the world supporting Ukraine, praying for Ukraine, you know, raising their voices to show they're not supporting these artificial reasons of the war, of the attack of Kyiv and all of Ukraine.
Yes, actually, we celebrated my grandson's birthday, the 23rd. It was our last peaceful day. We went to the museum, and then we went to eat somewhere out all together. And then, so at night, it happened, yes, early in the morning on Thursday, it happened.
My daughter, she's the youngest, and she was born in Kyiv, so our apartment in Kyiv is the only home she knows. And time to time, she's crying to, she wants to go back home.
Many were able to flee, some to the west. Some people, like, they left Kyiv, but for the places not so far away from Kyiv, like they have some summer houses or relatives in the villages or anything like this. So they went to those directions.
The whole world thinks that we will lose because Russia is a super country that has a lot. A friend of mine is a professor, and he said that his students and any direction who's a journalist or who's draws pictures, anything that they do, they got the guns or whatever, the military stuff, and they want to fight. He was talking to me and crying over the phone. How much courage they have, that they're ready to die. They have no fear to fight for the country.
Many friends in U.S., they also write us and call us, and they say, you know, you're welcomed, you can stay, we have place to live. This is a very touching moment. I can feel the real love and care from side of the people who know us and people who don't even know us. I think this is the power which is stronger than any weapon and any aggression. This is a power of love. And I want to thank everyone who is reaching out to people who are in need.
And that was Alex Ganyev, Katya Sergiev, and Bogdan Prashepchek, members of the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who are in Ukraine, or actually in one of those cases, having just left Ukraine and being interviewed in Romania. It's interesting to hear what's been happening there. You know, I actually want to push us through to the next section of our show by playing one more clip of audio that has to do with Ukraine. This is another Latter-day Saint, actually, talking about what's happening in Ukraine and really about the response to what's happening there. Take a listen. It's just over a minute long.
I do hear the president. He says that we are not going to send any boots to the ground in Ukraine or aircraft above Ukraine. I appreciate that. I think he wants to avoid a direct confrontation between two superpowers, because that has the potential of escalating into a world war with unthinkable consequence. At the same time, the president says, and I agree, that we need to honor our commitments under the NATO charter to defend our NATO allies. And I can't be sure that Putin won't step into Poland or Romania or the Balkans or Finland. You don't know where a megalomaniac dictator is going to head. So I hope he doesn't do those things. But if he does, we, along with our allies throughout the world, will be expected to step up. I believe we should step up in that case. By the way, I'd also note, I think with regards to Ukraine, they're going to have a hard time holding on to it if they're lucky enough to succeed in capturing Kyiv. They may or may not do that. But if they do, the Ukrainian people are not going to say, okay, you won, we're going to be quiet now. And the battle is going to go on, and it's going to be costly and bloody for Russia to try and hold on to their gains.
That's obviously Senator Mitt Romney. And Jeff Parrott, you were on the press call, that press call with the senator. He's there expressing what a lot of people have said, an expression of respect for the people of Ukraine and for their, you know, resilience. And I know that on that press call, Romney talked about various other aspects of what's happening there and how the U.S. might get involved, for example, energy policy. Can you tell us a little bit about what he said there, Jeff?
Romney did go a little bit further first with his World War analogy, and comparing President Vladimir Zelensky to the wartime prime minister of the UK, Winston Churchill, back who helped lead the UK through the Blitz and eventually an Allied victory in World War II. As far as energy policy, Romney made the conflict a little bit more local. And mentioned how Utah could help balance the energy equation globally that's going to be affected by the sanctions that a large portion of the world is putting on Russia right now.
And was that, I mean, basically Utah materials could be used to balance the energy budget of the world? I mean, he mentioned even uranium, right?
He did. He mentioned uranium, which I even had to call our reporter, Zach Podmore, immediately after the call and ask about uranium production in the state. And Zach said, we do have active mines here in the state that just aren't currently in the process of being mined. The other resource Romney brought up was coal, and said some of that coal balance could come from Utah, either directly to Europe or to countries that are feeding Europe more energy resources to backfill those losses.
This was a pretty long press conference, and there was a lot of questions about what happened and what's been going on in Ukraine. This is the conference itself, I think, was billed as a response to the State of the Union address, which I want to get to. But first, I want to bring in Robert Gierke, news columnist, and just on how things have been unfolding in Ukraine. I don't know. I mean, it's been scary. I was a kid in the late 70s, early 80s, and the Cold War fears were strong at the time. And that's part of what Romney talked about, was the, you know, the unthinkability of a global war, of a world war between world powers. Anything to say there, Robert?
I mean, it does have some strong Cold War vibes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And there's some brinksmanship, I think, going on, too, because, you know, if you studied World War One, the reason we got sucked into that is because of treaties and so forth. And we've got this treaty with NATO, and now the war is on the borders of NATO. There's some real peril. And I think, you know, if you've been following this burning nuclear reactor in Ukraine, it's nerve wracking. And it has been interesting, I think, to see the world coalesce against Putin for the most part, China perhaps being the exception. You know, the UN Security Council's vote was overwhelming, and there is strong global resistance to it. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of sort of second thoughts given to, you know, people made fun of Mitt Romney 10 years ago when he was running for president and said Russia was the greatest threat to global security and to the nation. And there's been a lot of pieces saying, well, I guess he was right. I don't know if I'd necessarily go that far. But, yeah, I mean, he's been proven to, you know, at least have understood the risk that Vladimir Putin could pose to global stability. I do want to, I do have a bit of a qualm with his assertion and the assertion that we've heard from other Utah members of the congressional delegation that somehow Utah oil is going to be a solution to the energy problem. Oil has been the problem of our global instability for the last several wars we've been in. And so, you know, if we weren't reliant on foreign oil, we wouldn't necessarily be in this mess. And I think the way out of that is not necessarily to double down on oil. But yeah, it's disheartening and unsettling to watch this play out.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, again, Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Jeff Parrott, I want to, you know, we were talking about this response to Ukraine, but a lot of what Romney was saying had to do with the State of the Union address, which happened this week as well, and began, of course, the president began with Ukraine. And you did a sort of, I guess we're kind of jumping topics here, but you did a sort of wrap up of the our congressional delegation's response to the State of the Union. Is there any, this might be a really broad question, but if there's any way to encapsulate that, I know that a number of members started by sort of lauding the president, but then there was a turn in what they said. Can you talk about the response of our delegation to the State of the Union?
Yeah, the delegation has been on board with President Biden's response to Ukraine across the board. There are, I think, fringe Republican members of the Republican Congress that has, at least in language, aligned themselves with Putin's invasion in Ukraine. And we have not seen any of the members of Utah's delegation do that. Everyone was very much on board with what the president said in regards to Ukraine, in regards to supporting NATO. Mm-hmm. But everyone kind of jumped off board as far as domestic policy goes, as far as spending, as far as inflation, kind of like the normal Republican talking points.
Sure. In response, and politics is ever present in American, politics, I guess, is the way to put it. But I don't know, is there a way to sort of, is there any specific unifying complaint that the members of Utah's GOP had about the State of the Union? Or is that too hard to try and summarize?
The one that I can recall is certainly spending, and how that's affecting, again, inflation, how that money is, Republicans argue, eventually going to need to be paid back. Utah is benefiting or will benefit from some of the spending. I know Mitt Romney has talked about the infrastructure package that just recently passed.
Yeah.
And how that's going to help and how that has actually even figured into what Utah legislators have been talking about on the Hill the last couple of weeks and how that's affecting Utah's budget and where that money will be spent.
If I could, I mean, sure. I pull back the curtain a little bit. I worked in D.C. for a number of years and covered many of these states of the Union. These reactions are all written before the speech is given. They didn't know what he was going to say. They weren't reacting to what he was going to say. This was just propagating political talking points. Nothing he could have said or done would have changed that, you know, they were going to talk about inflation and crime and spending. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a show, I think. Mm-hmm. But you know, this is, I think what we got from this speech is sort of an agenda for the upcoming election, for the midterm election. And so you can anticipate that you're going to hear a lot more about spending and inflation and crime and so forth from the Republican candidates in the upcoming election.
You know, I can't help but bring up the thing, you know, there's this moment of drama in, I don't know if you want to call it drama or whatever, but I guess Senator Romney referred to it as something that was embarrassing, this moment in the State of the Union where the president was interrupted by a couple of members of Congress who were shouting about, I don't even know what they were shouting about, but I know that Senator Romney condemned them. And Jeff Parrott, you were on that press call where Romney had something to say about that. Can you tell us what he said?
Yeah, I think
I'm not setting it up very well because I haven't really explained it. It was Marjorie Taylor Greene and
Lauren Boebert.
Yeah.
I think they were attacking the president and shouting out during the State of the Union about what they've accused him as far as his responsibility for the deaths of the soldiers at the Kabul airport gate in the final moments of the war in Afghanistan. Romney, I think perhaps unsurprisingly, did say that those comments were repugnant And go ahead.
It reminded me, actually, if I could go on a little stem winder here, that there was a Simpsons episode where it's Loggins, Oates, Messina, and Simpson, and they play, it's the second greatest band in the world, and people show up to boo them. It's like, if you're, and Lisa asks, why did they pay money to come boo us? Like, I just don't understand the idea of these two representatives showing up at this event that typically has some gravitas and decorum, and heckling him throughout like they're Statler and Waldorf. It was just
the Muppet Show.
I'm going Simpsons, Muppet Show. I'm going all across the board. It just is kind of disappointing, I guess. It kind of shows where we are in this country. And you know, Joe Wilson, I shouted, "You lie," at Obama. Nancy Pelosi ripped up Donald Trump's speech. It's not like it's unprecedented, but it's kind of mind-boggling that they would even bother to do that.
Romney called it "been on performing" as opposed to legislating.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it is performance. They're going to fundraise off of this, I'm sure. You know, it's this politics, the sort of climate of politics we're in, that the spectacle drives the narrative rather than actual, you know, dialogue.
Yeah, he talked about it being sort of notoriety or gaining, fundraising even, or making money on the internet, mm-hmm. was the way that Romney put it in that call, as I recall.
There's a lot that
is in that response from the State of the Union. There's obviously, we've kind of jumped between topics here, and we do actually have to head to our first break in the show. And so we will do that. But when we come back, we will turn to we're going to turn to where we are now in the state of COVID in Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty, State Watch editor Jeff Parrott, and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments. Call us up at 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, although I've got to bring that up so I can pay attention to it. Aaron Alberty, COVID cases in Utah have been dropping pretty significantly. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has some new guidance for Americans. And here in Salt Lake County, the head of the health department offered some advice as well. I'm wondering if I could just sort of have you paint the picture of where things stand right now in the pandemic. Obviously, it's not over yet, but the landscape has changed. To what extent?
So we're down to, a couple few hundred new cases a day on average. That's we're down to as few new cases per day as we were in probably early July of last year, which is great news. I mean, you know, the average cases per day right now are 1/27th of where they were at the peak in January, when we were getting 10,000 new cases a day on average, as a result of the highly contagious Omicron variant of the virus. So cases are way, way down, and they've fallen really precipitously nationwide. They've fallen more quickly this year than they did last year in the winter to spring time. Of course, they had a lot farther to fall because, you know, the peaks in January were so unprecedentedly high. I don't know if unprecedentedly is a word.
But I like it though. It is now.
We're going to keep it. Also funner. We need to push around the word funner instead of more fun. Anyway, it is funner now than it was last year too. The CDC has changed its masking recommendations for people who don't have particular health risks for COVID,
right,
or who don't have close contact with people who have higher risks. So if you are at high risk for COVID, it is still recommended that you mask. And if you live with or work with people who are at high risk for serious COVID, it's still recommended that you mask no matter where you are. However, throughout most of the state, if you don't have any such risks or wouldn't be imperiling others who do, then the recommendation is no longer that you need to mask. unless you're in a high transmission area, which a couple of counties still are.
And we are not here in Salt Lake County. Do you have at hand the two counties that are, Aaron, in high transmission?
Yeah. Tooele and San Juan
okay.
are the two counties that are still considered high risk, but most of the state is not.
You know, there's that sort of, you know, I don't know, I'm a fully vaccinated and boosted person who's in relatively good health, but you know, I've so far avoided the virus myself, but the biggest fear that I've always had was about being a conduit of the virus to get it to somebody who is vulnerable. And the advice here is basically you're less likely to be that if you're not, you know, in direct contact with somebody who is vulnerable, though that's kind of hard to gauge, I guess. Maybe I'll bring the news columnist in on this, Aaron, unless you have a comment there.
Well, yeah. One of the things that when Dr. Angela Dunn, the director of the Salt Lake County Health Department, spoke on this earlier this week, and one of the things that she pointed to was, you know, there may still be businesses that are asking people to mask. And if they do ask people to mask, that it is important to do that because they may be doing that because they have an employee who is at high risk. And so, you know, if somebody asks for people to wear masks, that it's best to respect that request and go ahead and do it.
Yeah, and then just statewide, I mean, there's the governor has, you know, he called on businesses to lift all mask and vaccine requirements. That was earlier this month. Governor Cox said something along those lines.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, what Dr. Dunn was speaking to is you saw kind of when the mask requirements were lifted earlier in the pandemic, that a lot of businesses still were like, we still request you wear masks. I mean, I know I visited some
right.
some businesses that said that. There's nothing precluding somebody from asking for masks. So if that's what they're asking, that there may be a very good reason, and to keep that in mind rather than
true.
Throwing a snit fit because you don't like it or something.
Right. And the fact that maybe somebody who works there or somebody who is connected either can't be vaccinated or is at high risk. Yeah, I guess maybe I am gonna just, Aaron, put you on pause for a second and bring in the news columnist Robert Gerke. I know you track the numbers regularly as well. How do things look from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too surprising that we've, you know, that the numbers have fallen precipitously and we're in a pretty good situation. I wouldn't say good, but pretty good. You know, because we've seen this all across the country and the globe right now. This Omicron wave was steep, intense, sharp, and short-lived, and now we're kind of back to a normal situation that we'll probably be living with for a long time. I think, you know, if you are immunocompromised, I think that is the concern. And you know, it's unfortunate, but I think that you're kind of on your own at this point and have to take care of yourself. And that means, I think, wearing masks when needed, but also the booster shots. Those who are immunocompromised are now eligible for their second booster shot. The boosters have been the most effective way to combat this virus, and the data on them is conclusive that they work. And so, especially when it comes to keeping out of the hospital or the morgue. So, you know, that's an important tool that I think we need to keep our eye on. I also am kind of encouraged by this program that Test and Treat that President Biden rolled out during the State of the Union, where if you go test positive, you can get the antiviral medications at that, you know, from your pharmacist. And I think that's going to be an important tool because those have been very effective against most of the variants. So, you know, there's still potential out there for a variant to sneak up on us. So we need to keep an eye on monitoring this. But as of right now, I'm pretty encouraged by where we are. Notwithstanding the antics and the policies of the Utah legislature, I should add.
Aaron, in terms of how things might change, I mean, Robert Gerke there talked about variants of concern, the potential for, you know, eventually cases to go the other direction and start building up. Is there a statewide plan in place or, you know, from the county level, or is this sort of piecemeal for when and or if and when things turn the other direction?
I mean, as far as a plan goes, the state is winding down its testing operations, but it says it does want to keep, you know, supplies on hand in case we need to do testing again. I would echo what Robert said about boosters, not just in terms of advice to get it. I think one thing that it remains concerning is that the Omicron variant, with the Omicron variant, there was research, including research out of Utah, that showed that simply getting the first two courses of the vaccine wasn't terribly effective, you know, a few months afterwards against the Omicron variant. And the way mutations work is, you know, a variant is kind of less likely to become dominant if it is responsive to the vaccine, because it won't survive.
Right.
It won't be spread around. So it's likely that future variants may be similarly, you know, resistant, or there may be kind of a deadline as to the effectiveness of the vaccine against them. And the reason that that's concerning is right now, fewer than 27% of Utahns have received their boosters. And, you know, the research last month showed that if you're not boosted, it's kind of closer to not being vaccinated. I mean, it's still better than being completely unvaccinated, but, you know, it's not really that great. Like, you really do need your booster. And the longer we go without people getting their booster shots, the more and more the victory of vaccines in the first go around kind of fades. So the less and less protected we will be for a future variant that may necessitate a booster dose. And the uptake of those boosters has been really slow. I mean, like, it's been 25 to 27% for weeks and weeks at this point. Okay. So that's not really going anywhere. And that doesn't bode that well for our state's resistance to future variants.
And I think one last point I want to make before we, you know, before we walk away from COVID, before we just say, okay, we're done with it.
Right.
We should keep in mind that there are untold thousands of long haulers out there who are still suffering symptoms from their infections. And it's a mystery, you know, how this is going to affect people in the long term, especially kids. You know, kids were pretty resilient, but they got it, and they could be dealing with some of these consequences for a long, long time. And so I think we need to put some, you know, our scientific community really sort of rallied to try to shut this down. I think there also needs to be some effort put into answering these questions surrounding long haulers.
Let's bring Jeff in. Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
And I think just as far as like mental health, like there's 4,400 families that are now living with a loved one they've lost in the last couple of years. And that's going to be
here in Utah.
Yeah, here in Utah. And that's going to be hard and difficult and like trying to figure out how to move on and what Christmas looks like next year and what those next birthdays look like.
And there was a story in the Tribune today about a surge in late stage cancers diagnosis because
you're taking my underplayed story,
sorry,
Aaron. I was actually going to ask you about that because people have been delaying getting screened. Is that the idea?
This is crucially important, and I know it's in politic to use one's own story for the underplayed story of the week, but this is a big deal. Doctors at Intermountain reviewed their colonoscopy rates during the pandemic, and they were down by half, 50%. Of the number of screening colonoscopies that they were doing before is what's been going on lately. And accordingly, colorectal cancer rates have been increasing, especially, you know, the oncologist said that he's seen about a 15% increase in advanced cases of colorectal cancer, that's stage 3 or higher. So that's really bad, and it's really preventable. And, you know, I mean, having had a personal family history, like a fairly extensive personal family history of colorectal cancer, it's a really distressing thing because it is preventable. That makes it really heartbreaking when it hits.
People delaying care is the idea there, or delaying screening. And so, go get screened. Aaron, we could also dip into hospitalizations being down significantly and the fact that there is this backlog of surgeries. I noticed some of your reporting was about, what's being done about that backlog, especially at the University of Utah Hospital. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the U Hospital has brought in a team of, I think, about 30 naval personnel. It's a Navy medical team to help out with surgeries. That includes doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, and administrators to help out with the backlog of surgeries. They have about 500 surgeries that are pending. And, you know, the staff right now, I mean, staffing has been an issue for healthcare providers throughout the pandemic. It became especially acute during the Omicron variant because employees were falling ill. But during that time, they had to delay a lot of surgeries. And at this point, they're trying to catch up. However, you know, staffing hasn't entirely rebounded. The hospital said that they have about double the number of vacancies that they normally have, that they've had before the pandemic at this point, which is a lot. I mean, it's a healthcare system of 14,000 people, and there's usually, you know, several hundred vacancies at any given time. Well, now they're kind of over 1,000, and they're just everywhere nationwide.
Aaron, just quickly on the naval sort of attachment to the University of Utah Hospital, how does that happen? Are they assigned there? Did the U of U request them? It's just an interesting sort of tidbit that.
Yeah, and you know, the U isn't the only provider that's done this. A team of National Guard personnel went down to St. George a couple weeks ago to help out at the hospital there, as well as at some long-term care facilities, which also have had extremely short staffs, that was the case at, you know, nursing homes and stuff before the pandemic too. But the hospital CEO said that hospital administrators worked with the Navy and the governor's office to make that request. And it was something that came up during the Omicron surge, because that was when it was like, no, really, we are losing a lot of ground in terms of keeping these surgeries going. Now, these surgeries that were delayed, they're not time sensitive surgeries. It's not like they're letting cancer patients just, you know, languish while their cancer spreads.
Right.
They may do a surgery to remove cancer, but then they wouldn't do the follow-up reconstructive surgery because, you know, that's not time sensitive. And if there is a complication, if they don't have the ICU beds or the hospital beds to care for somebody after a complication, then that can be a risky endeavor. Hmm. So those were the kinds of things that got put off.
Got it. You know, before we head to our next break, I actually want to ask Robert Gerke or Aaron, both of you, or either of you, the two of you maybe, a question about why booster uptake is so low in the state of Utah. I mean, Aaron said that, Robert, that it was like 27, 26%, something like that. That seems pretty low.
Aaron probably has a better sense of it than I do. I mean, I would assume there are some who are booster resistant. Maybe some people thought, well, I had the two, you know, and maybe they had a hard time with one of the shots and didn't want to get the third. There's some issues with eligibility, right? You have to wait 6 months after your second shot to get the booster. Mm-hmm. So if you were a late adopter, you may not even have been eligible until recently. So it's probably a multitude of reasons.
Okay. Yeah, Aaron, any thoughts there? I mean, obviously we'll see it go up. Robert's pointing out the fact that there is that delay, but it does seem low to start with.
Yeah, it is low to start with. And, you know, this isn't something I've reported, and I generally am reluctant to speculate, but I will say it's been a pattern throughout the pandemic that it has been very difficult for health experts to communicate changes in advice that once, you know, and this is a new illness and its treatments are all new and everything about it is new. So we know we make our best guess, you know, science kind of comes to the conclusions that it can in a little amount of time, dispenses the advice that, you know, dispenses the conclusions. And then when those conclusions change with more information, it's difficult to kind of top off people's brain cups later because they've absorbed the original advice. And so, you know, it makes people a little bit angry sometimes when, okay, well, with the original, you know, with the Alpha variant or even the Delta variant, maybe the vaccine in its original form was 90%+ effective. When it goes down to more like half or more, you know, a little more than half, then it's like, well, rather than just recognizing that the information has changed and conditions have changed and the, you know, medical advice is responding accordingly, people sometimes develop doubts instead, or they just don't hear it, or they just don't internalize it. It's just really hard to update medical information and medical advice, you know, on a month by month basis, and for everyone, especially people who may not be COVID news junkies, to absorb that information.
That's an interesting aspect that people just aren't paying attention. I hadn't, you know, that right, that maybe they're not up to date on what is the proper advice.
I mean, I can say that my own neighbor, you know, has a number of risk factors and was early on eligible for the vaccine. And when the with the first two doses, you know, really excited to get it. I drove him over to the site. We took pictures and stuff. Like, it was a big deal. And getting the booster was actually, it was kind of a lag with
So here's a question for you too, Aaron, just on the COVID news junkie front. I mean, where some of us who are paying close attention, we had a call from Chris in St. George who is, you know, he's had his booster and he's wondering if there's talk of, you know, the fourth shot. Are we going to need a fourth shot?
The fourth shot has been recommended for people who are immunocompromised. And keep in mind, for people who are immunocompromised, the original course of the vaccine is three shots, not two. And that's anybody like with organ transplants, chemotherapy, autoimmune disorders, things like that. So it's, that's already been recommended and people are advised to head to the pharmacy and get that. For everyone else, you know, the science is still out.
Got it. Waiting to see, Chris. So we don't have the exact answer yet, but for some folks, that is the answer. We are going, Aaron.
Oh, I would like to add. I'm sorry. I know that you're trying to move things along here, but I would like to add, as far as those cancer screenings are concerned, chemotherapy does make you immunosuppressed, and you don't want to be immunosuppressed during a pandemic, even at its you know, ebbs, even at its nadirs. So, just please get your cancer screening so you don't end up on chemotherapy and like immunocompromised in this situation.
Advice from Aaron Alberti, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And thank you for your reporting, Aaron. We're going to head to our next break in the show. Still more to come. We'll talk a little bit about the end of the state legislative session. Today is the last day. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Aaron Alberti, Jeff Parrott, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, drawing on the excellent journalism of Salt Lake Tribune reporters. You can join us by calling 801-355-8255. Or tweeting your questions and comments to at KCPW. Robert Gerke, it is the last day of the state legislative session, and I'm wondering, you know, I'd like to talk about what you're paying attention to today, but I'm also curious about what you see as having been the big things that have occurred so far. I mean, there's a lot to cover, and it becomes more of a logjam at the end of the session. There's last-minute bills, there's everything that it's kind of a fire hose, but what's your focus today, and what have you been paying attention to?
As is often the case on the last day, we end up with just a few sort of odds and ends. Most of the big heavy lifting has been done. You've got some controversial measures still left. HB 11, which is Kira Berkland's bill regarding transgender athletes competing in sports, is still sort of one of those that's in flux. Originally, they had a thing that they were going to measure, you know, gait and, you know, muscle mass and things like that to decide who competes where. They were going to take out some of those sort of eugenics-oriented measures and try to find some other way to do this. So that one is still kind of teed up, and we're waiting to see what happens. There's a bill that Joel Ferry has on animal enterprises, which I think is getting a lot of attention right now. This is a bill that says that cities and counties can't regulate animal enterprises, which is things like ranching. It's also things like puppy mills. It's things like zoos and rodeos. Only the state could regulate those, which has a lot of, obviously, Humane Society is upset about that because of the puppy mill aspect of it. The cities and counties are upset about it because they don't want me having a rodeo in my backyard, I guess. So that one's going to be an interesting one to watch. So, yeah, but I mean, we're kind of to the point where it's a lot of odds and ends because they have done the big things. They did the Great Salt Lake legislation. The Utah Lake Authority passed last night. We've got the homelessness package passed. This is, $55 million for a supportive housing. To try to help people get off the streets and stay off the streets. And then there's an affordable housing bill, but Steve Waldrop sponsored that I wrote about this week that would send money to rural Utah for housing, and it would try to create this revolving loan fund to try to get more affordable housing built. That one's done and put to bed. And so, you know, there's a lot. Jeff was mentioning when we were off the air, a $25 billion budget, the largest in state history, which is kind of the way this always works. Every year is usually bigger than the last. But, you know, it's a hefty increase for education. There's a cost of living increase for state workers. I believe it's 3.5% with an additional increase for areas that are desperate, where there are desperate shortages, places like corrections officers.
Yeah, staff shortages there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there is a lot that's moved. I also think when we were talking about what did happen in the legislature, we probably should talk about what didn't happen in the legislature.
Yeah.
Coming in, we were worried about, or we were keeping an eye on, I guess I should say, the things like the election bills that were trying to get rid of mail-in voting because there was this fraud conspiracy in the last election. That failed.
There was some maneuvering, though, on election sort of security measures.
There have been some security measures to try to tighten it. Those were done with the support of the county clerks and the lieutenant governor's office. I mean, so what we got are some security measures, but they're consensus security measures.
Okay.
It's not a wholesale, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing. School vouchers got a lot of attention. Candace Perucci's bill failed resoundingly. It failed by 31 votes in the House. Wasn't close.
I always want, just in case listeners don't know, I mean, a school voucher was a way to pay parents to send their kids to private or mm-hmm. other schools, to pull them out of public education and take money with them.
Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
Okay, exactly. That failed.
There was a bill to launch investigations into teachers who taught divisive lessons. That bill failed in a rather embarrassing fashion for the sponsor as well. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that I think got a lot of attention that was sort of being driven by this mobilized vocal minority on the far right wing, the conspiracy theorists and whatnot, ended up not getting, I guess we could say, cooler heads prevailed and ended up not getting any traction this session.
What about, I mean, you mentioned that Utah Lake bill passed. What does it do? It's the creating the Utah Lake Authority. Is that right?
Yeah, the legislature's been creating a lot of these authorities. And what it does is it takes, rather than having a piecemeal approach where different cities work with maybe the state that actually owns the lake, this creates one sort of centralized clearinghouse that can do the contracting for restoration projects. It can bond, it can issue bonds to do some of these projects. It's supposed to sort of streamline the process of trying to clean up the lake. Critics remain convinced, even though the sponsor insists it's not the case, critics remain convinced that this is paving the way for the Utah Island project, the real estate project where they want to build islands in the lake and put houses on them. Again, the sponsor says that's not the case. It's agnostic in that regard, although it does give this authority the tools that would be necessary to sort of facilitate that in terms of like the bonding and the contracting and so forth. So we're going to have to keep watching that. It looks like it might be a wolf in sheep's clothing.
How about with the other port, there's several ports, as you said, these authorities, not ports. I was going to go make a segue there, and I threw it out early. The Utah Inland Port, there was a bill that strips Salt Lake City of its representation on the port board and others. What's happening with that?
That one's passed. I think, Jeff, do you know?
I was just pulling it up.
Right. I believe that one has passed. Oh, yeah, it did. It passed last night.
Okay.
It shrinks the Inland Port Authority Board, which currently is 11 voting members, down to 5. And so Salt Lake City is losing a member. Salt Lake County is losing 2 members. Magna and West Valley are losing voting members. And in their place, the Senate President and House Speaker are appointing 1 more member. So now they'll appoint 3 of the 5 members. you know, this is, and to preview my piece for the weekend, this is one of the ways that the legislature slowly takes power from the cities and counties and the executive branch, is by creating these authorities that then they stack with legislators. Another similar authority, the Point of the Mountain Authority, is getting some funding, getting some the ability to raise revenue and spend revenue to redevelop the old Draper prison site. They've been in the planning stages for a number of years. Now they're going to start progressing down the road of actually redeveloping it. So, you know, again, it's there's a lot going on. And so, well,
yeah, there's tons going on. It's the last day. I guess, Jeff, is there anything that you're paying close attention to in the final sort of hours of the state legislative session, or is most of it already done from your perspective?
There's still a lot of reporting, still a lot going on up at the Hill. Like Robert said, the big high dollar packages have gone through the gate and are just now waiting on the governor's signature, which he's got now 20 days, or after today, he'll have another 20 days to decide on whether he's going to bring those into law or he's going to veto them. Robert, we were just working on that story, your weekend story yesterday, and there's not a huge appetite, it seems, for vetoes.
Yeah, the governor's vetoed 4 bills out of about 500 that have come across his desk since he took office, which is a little bit, it's close to his predecessor, you know, Governor Herbert. There's going to be a push for him to veto some of these bills. I already know there's efforts underway to get him to veto a few of them. So I guess we kind of need to wait and see how that works out. He did issue a veto threat on the voucher bill that some think maybe moved the needle a little bit, with the assumption being even if the voucher bill passes, that it would not end well for and it, so the veto threat can be effective, but I wouldn't anticipate that the governor is going to come in and like a bull in a china shop and start throwing the veto word around very, very freely.
We are just up against the end of the show here, and I neglected to bring Aaron Alberti in on the conversation about the legislature. And Aaron, I don't know I don't know if you're still there. And then secondarily, I don't know if you're following closely the state legislative session. And if you are, is there anything you want to weigh in on here?
I was saving it for the underplayed story. You know, take another one from me.
Yeah, let's take your underplayed story. I won't do it. No, we'll come back. We'll do it right now. We'll turn right now to our underplayed stories of the week, and I'll let you start off. Why don't we do that? This is our final segment of the show where we feature a story that you may have missed or should otherwise have your attention drawn to. Aaron, what's your pick?
That schools in Utah are going to provide free menstrual products to students in the bathroom.
Wow.
So uterus havers of Utah, rejoice. No more tying your jackets and flannel shirts around your waist.
Wow. Hooray. Hooray. That was a measure that passed, I think, recently. And obviously, there's no threat of veto or anything there. Thank you for that pick for underplayed story of the week, Aaron Alberti, with that pick. Jeff Parrott, are you ready with pick for underplayed story?
I can go.
Yeah.
Colby Peterson had a story that posted today. That there was a young man, a 22-year-old Joseph Spencer, who was struck and killed by a Utah County sheriff's deputy who was speeding in an unmarked car. They said he was going to a police standoff. So Spencer's family has filed an intent to sue the county. I think there's going to be more playing out on this. Summit County has taken over the investigation. They often do that, parcel it out when there's a conflict of interest. So they're going to make an announcement shortly. But, I think this is an interesting case just because, you got an unmarked police car. It was on duty, presumably. But, it's going to be one to watch. Check out Colby's story at sltrib.com.
Okay. Yeah, I had not seen that. So that is totally underplayed for me, and I will check it out. Jeff Parrott, what's your pick for underplayed story?
And just online at our website now is a story from Stephanie Russell about a Salt Lake City artist whose feminist art will now be gracing Pabst's Blue Ribbon beer cans later this fall. Definitely check it out.
I'm going to see a lot more of that art than most art I see. So.
All right. I love it. Those are great picks for underplayed story of the week. I am underprepared. I have not chosen anything. So You know, there's some interesting reporting on the fact that Salt Lake County has millions of dollars more in pandemic money. And there's a report, I can't remember who it's by, but on the generational investment that that Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson is going to make. It's by Leah Larson, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. You can check those out at sltrip.com. I guess, you know, we actually have one more minute before we wrap up the show. Anybody have a second pick for Underplayed Story? either Aaron or Robert or Jeff, because I'm totally unprepared.
I would say that Aaron Falk did a nice profile on a UVU basketball player who's Ukrainian. His family's in Ukraine. And it kind of captures some of the, I guess, the anxiety that they feel and with, you know, being so far away from family members in such an uncertain time. And it's really nicely written, too. So check out Aaron's piece on that.
Yeah, and then Andy Larson actually had a piece on former Utah Jazz player who was
Fisenko. Yeah,
yeah,
and he had a money quote in there where he says he focuses all of his rage and hate on one man who's causing this, and it was
on Vladimir Putin. He says, "I've got the quote here. It says, I'm a pacifist in my heart, but I want one person to suffer. I want one person to suffer the most." And he wants, yeah, it goes on. It's pretty tragic, but interesting statement. And you can check that out. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
And if folks are like wanting to help families and refugees and people from Ukraine, Kimball Herc has State Watch reporter did a quick story yesterday on Governor Spencer Cox's new fund drive and donations drive. You can check out that story on our website right now.
At sltrip.com. It's also where the rest of the reporting that we have been featuring today can be found. Jeff Parrott, Robert Gerke, and Aaron Alberti, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining me today for Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune, also heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts at kcbw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.